You remember this picture, which outlines the strategy that we're pursuing here? We did these two steps from here to there and from there to here already. So we started with the classical Klein-Gordon equation in the Hamiltonian formalism, the genre transformed to the Lagrangian formalism in order to get a covariant formulation in terms of the action. Then at that point, we were ready to upgrade from special relativity to general relativity. But it was still first quantized. And today we will go from general relativity, first quantized, doing a Legendre transform backwards to the Hamiltonian formalism. At that point, we will find out what the canonically conjugate field is to phi. It's no longer phi dot in general relativity. It's going to be more general. And that's why we did all of this detour here in order to find out from a covariant formalism what the canonically conjugate variable to phi is. Namely, we will obtain it by doing the Legendre transform here. And once we're here, we are then ready to quantize because we know what phi and pi are, and so we can do the canonical commutation relations. So this is where we are. Yellow arrow is. Right, so we arrived at the coordinate system independent Klein-Gordon action. So this is the kinetic term with the derivatives, and then the mass term, and here, if you want to, we can have a potential term. And that potential term can also contain interactions with other fields, which we would describe with a small phi field variable. Here we allow almost arbitrary metric tensors, g mu nu of x. Even, and that was the main point last time, we allow any g mu nu of x as long, even if there is no coordinate system in which it reduces to eta mu nu. And that meant that it's a curved space time, right? If there's no coordinate system in which it reduces to eta mu nu everywhere, then it's a curved space time. However, we do not allow completely arbitrary g mu nu of x. We require that whatever point you choose, there's got to be a change of coordinates such that at least at that point, the metric takes this form. That was the equivalence principle. Because this guarantees that at any point locally, you can choose coordinates such that it looks like special relativity. And of course, we restrict attention also only to those metrics for which we get the eta mu nu of special relativity. In principle, you can write down metric tensors that have a different signature. Okay, so this is the equivalence principle. I wrote it up here again. So how can we now identify the presence of curvature? In principle, I just gave you a criterion. Namely, we can check whether or not there exists a change of coordinates such that the metric is eta mu nu everywhere. But how can we check for the existence of coordinate system that does that? That's very difficult. In principle, we would have to write down all possible coordinate system transformations to check whether among them there are some that turn g mu nu into eta mu nu everywhere. That's not very practical. So here's a practical method. Assume we're given a metric tensor as an explicit matrix-valued function in some coordinate system. And we want to know, does this describe a curved spacetime or a flat one? Is this just Minkowski space in funny coordinates, or is it not? Is it really some curved spacetime? And this problem of determining whether or not this is flat space-time is solved in differential geometry. And the first step towards that is to define the so-called Christoffel symbol functions. Capital gamma, mu, alpha, beta, defined in this particular way. It involves the metric tensor, and it involves ordinary derivatives of it. You see, remember these commas mean d by dx with respect to the corresponding index here. Okay, so that's the first step. We can certainly do this. If we're given a GMU of x, matrix-valued function explicitly, we can calculate this. And so we can calculate these gammas, these Christoffel symbols. Then what do we do with those? Well, once we have them, we can define the Riemann curvature tensor that you have hopefully all seen before many times. So the Riemann curvature tensor is given in terms of these Christoffel symbols, which we can now calculate. And the Riemann curvature tensor tells us whether or not there's curvature in our space-time. Whether or not the metric that we use to calculate this involves curvature or not. So here's how the curvature tensor operates. Imagine we have a point in space-time, an event in space-time, and we parallel transport a vector v in the direction of eta, and then in the direction of nu, and then back in the direction of eta, but parallel transported and back to x. Then this vector v arrives back here, but it might be rotated as it arrives back here. For example, if you do this on the surface of a sphere, then the parallel transport will return the vector slightly rotated from where it was pointing earlier. The rotation that this vector undergoes under a parallel transport in the parallelogram can be calculated from the Riemann curvature tensor. Namely, we have these two vectors, eta and nu, that span the parallelogram. And we take the Riemann curvature tensor here at the point x, where we start our parallel transport. And then we contract it with eta and nu. These are assumed to be short vectors. It's a small parallelogram, technically infinitesimally small. Now we have contracted two of the indices, the first two lower indices, and then we are left with a matrix that has one upper index and one lower index. Right? So once we choose the parallelogram, choose the vectors eta and nu, we contract them here with those two indices, and we're left with a matrix of A and D indices. And that's a rotation matrix. If we now contract the V, oh, there's an alpha here, that shouldn't be, that should, oh no, it's not an alpha, it's a D. So this D gets contracted with that D, and then we get a vector with indices A. That's the vector by which this has rotated. So the Riemann curvature tensor tells us how much parallel transport along a parallelogram is non-trivial. Now, it could also be that in a space-time, the parallelogram does not even close. So it could be that not only do we get the rotation of a vector as we transport it along a parallelogram, it could also be that as we travel this way, it doesn't even close. We don't even end up at the same point. If that happens, we say that the space-time has torsion. There is no evidence for torsion in nature, but it's interesting to know that it's a mathematical possibility. Also because in quantum theory tells us that nature usually tries everything out. So for example, a particle that would not have enough energy to go through a potential wall may still tunnel through it. There's a probability amplitude for every path. And therefore, in principle, we should expect that the quantum theory might also explore torsion. Even if the expectation value of it is zero, there might be quantum fluctuations into finite amounts of torsion. On the other hand, it has been shown that the existence of torsion can be reinterpreted as, instead of saying that this means that parallelograms don't close, you could also say, well, parallelograms close, but there is a force which keeps us from getting back to the same point. Basically, we are blown away by the wind. The torsion field as another force field that moves everything then over. You can read more about this in the text by Wald. Now, imagine, assume now that in a region A of space-time, we have that the Riemann curvature tensor is vanishing everywhere. Then and only then, there exist coordinates such that the metric tensor takes the form of special relativity, eta mu nu. So the vanishing of the curvature tensor tells us about the vanishing of curvature. So that's a much better way to check whether or not the space-time is flat than checking whether there is a change of coordinates that will make the metric look like eta mu nu. So now, what is the dynamics of space-time? What are the equations of motion for space-time's curvature or for space-time's metric? Which are the degrees of freedom of curvature for which we have to find an equation of motion even? So on one hand, we know there's going to be some dynamics for curvature, but what exactly do we mean? What is it that needs dynamics? We saw that the curvature of space-time is encoded in the matrix-valued metric function g mu nu of x. But g mu nu of x is a wasteful representation of the curvature. Because if g mu nu of x looks non-trivial, if when you spell it out as a 4x4 matrix-valued function of space and time, it looks non-trivial with lots of non-diagonal terms. And this could be for two different reasons. It could be that space-time has little or even no curvature, and g mu nu looks non-trivial just because of an unlucky choice of coordinates. It could really be just eta mu nu in disguise, having been transformed into a funny coordinate system. But it could also be that this is as simple as it can be, and the space-time is just full of non-trivial curvature. It's hard to tell by just looking at the g mu nu of x. You have to check out the curvature to find out whether we are dealing with curvature or not. So therefore, it would seem difficult to work with the g mu nu of x. It's just a wasteful thing. It contains lots of spurious degrees of freedom that are not physics, that are instead our choice of coordinate system. For example, there should be no dynamics of a choice of coordinate system. There shouldn't be any quantum fluctuations of choices of coordinate system, which is one of the main reasons why it's hard to quantize gravity. Because it's hard to identify what exactly degrees of freedom of curvature are. They are always meshed up with choices of coordinate system. And we can't quantize choices, only actual degrees of freedom. So it's hard to pinpoint in g mu nu where the degrees of freedom sit. Now, one might think, okay, so let's work with the r mu nu rho epsilon, with the curvature tensor. Maybe we should calculate the dynamics of the curvature tensor. But the trouble is that even that thing is coordinate system dependent. If we change our coordinate system, or more accurately, if we change bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces, then entries will change. It's true that they will only be zero, all of them, if the space is flat. But exactly what entries they take still depends on the coordinate system. So the strategy in order to find out what the dynamics of space-time is, is to use the degrees of freedom of curvature, of the curvature tensor, to build a scalar. Scalars being independent of choices of coordinate system. So the idea is to take the metric tensor and then calculate from it a scalar, a number that doesn't depend on the coordinate system. And then, whatever that number is, it's got to contain only physics. we will use that number, that scalar, as the action for gravity. And then the actions, the equation of motion, the equations of motion for gravity should follow from the action principle, and they do. So we need to define a scalar that encodes curvature. And let's start with the Riemann curvature tensor and then cook it down to a scalar. So here's the Riemann curvature tensor again with its four indices. And then if we contract the upper index with the middle one of the lower indices, we get the Ricci tensor. Now you may wonder, why the middle one of the lower indices? It doesn't have to be the middle one. There are symmetries between those two, for example. But it turns out that if you were to contract with this one or with that one, you either get the same or zero. You get the same if you contract with this one, because you get zero if you contract with the first one. So it's really the only choice. What we obtain here is the so-called Ricci tensor. It's just a poorer version of the Riemann curvature tensor. Poorer because if we know the Ricci tensor, we can no longer reconstruct what the Riemann curvature tensor is. Because we did the sum over terms. And you can't reconstruct what the terms of the sum were, knowing only the sum total. So now we have the Ricci tensor, but this thing still has indices. It's not a scalar. It still depends on the coordinate system. So as I said, Arminu contains strictly less information than the full Riemann curvature tensor. So we are making a bargain here, right? You see, on one hand, we want a scalar, something coordinate system independent, so that we can formulate the equations of motion in a coordinate system independent way. On the other hand, we seem to be losing degrees of freedom along the way, because this thing contains strictly less information than that. But we've got to be a little bit lucky that we still get a sensible theory. And we will have to see later on, what are these degrees of freedom that we were missing? And what do they do? Well, let me give it away already. So what we will find is that if R mu nu is vanishing, if the Ricci tensor is vanishing, then the curvature tensor may still be non-zero. Now, what would that be, though? What would be curvature where the Ricci tensor is vanishing, but the curvature tensor is not vanishing? Anybody know? Wild tensor, that's right. And it includes, for example, gravitational waves. It includes the vacuum solution. So it turns out that the degrees of freedom that we will distill out here are those that directly couple to matter. And the other degrees of freedom are those, the ones that we are losing here, are the ones that can persist even in the vacuum. Okay, so now from the Ricci tensor, we can go to the Ricci scalar by contracting those two indices. We need the metric for that, of course. Now, is this the only scalar that we can get? Not quite. We could simply have taken the metric and contracted it with itself. Then what do we get? Well, we get that since this is the inverse to that matrix, the first contraction gives us just a Kronecker delta, mu nu, but we set the two indices equal, so we are summing over the Kronecker delta. So we get 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 is 4, because the dimension is 4. So that's a scalar, but it knows nothing about the space-time except for its total number of dimensions. It knows nothing about the curvature, it just knows globally what the number of dimensions is. But it's definitely a scalar, and we could, in principle, put that into the action. And there's evidence that nature uses it. It's a cosmological constant. Now, the next simplest scalar that one can write down is this one, the Ricci scalar. And it turns out that any other scalars that you can build from the metric are ultimately combinations of higher powers of the Riemann curvature tensor and its contraction. And it turns out that they occur in the action. In fact, they have to occur in the action, and all of them have to occur in the action because of quantum field theoretical renormalization, something that we will come back to later. But they are all highly suppressed. They all naturally come with prefactors where you can predict that they have to be very small on dimensional ground. So the leading terms are these two, Ricci scalar and the constant, which will be the cosmological constant. So then the gravitational action looks like this, or the action of the universe, total action. Any question there? No? Okay. So the total action looks like this. We have the Klein-Gordon action. After all, we are focusing on the Klein-Gordon field here. And then we have the gravitational action, which, as we said, will start out with a constant term, and then the Ricci scalar, and then other higher order curvature terms, and the action of all the other fields, like for electrons, for quarks, for gluons, photons, and so on. They are all in here. And their interactions, of course. So the gravitational part of the action looks then like this. It's a scalar obtained from the metric, and as we said, it starts with a constant. So it's a multiple of the number 4, right? Because it's just g mu, plus a constant times the Ricci scalar, plus another constant, and then you have the Ricci scalar squared. And here you have other contractions of the Riemann curvature tensor and its contractions. You may wonder, if we write the total action like this, and the gravitational action is this, shouldn't we also add an action here which describes the interaction between gravity and the other fields? I mean, for example, if you just write down the action of the electron and the action of photon, then they are independent theories. They don't interact with each other. You need an interaction term as well to make them interact with each other. Here, we just added the gravity action, but we didn't add an extra term that would describe how gravity interacts with the rest. Do we have to add such a term? In principle, yes, there could be such terms. But there is automatically an interaction of gravity with everything anyway. And the reason is that in these actions, there are derivatives which become covariant derivatives that have the metric in them. And all of those terms have a square root of g in the measure factor in order to make them covariant. So therefore, these terms automatically contain an interaction with gravity, which is why we say that gravity couples to everything. You cannot switch it off. Now, experimental evidence shows that there is such a constant, finite and positive, and there is this constant here, and there's no experimental evidence for these to be non-zero. So we only have, so far, experimental evidence for the two leading terms. And the experimental evidence fixes what C0 is and what C1 is. And we usually write it in this way, that we pull these numbers in front, and then we say, this lambda is a cosmological constant, and that is Newton's constant here. Now, these higher order terms, as I said, in principle, ought to be there because of quantum field theory. Quantum field theory actually induces higher order terms. But that is a conundrum, because if the action contains these higher order terms, then generally the equations of motion that follow from the action principle, saying that the variation of the action with respect to the metric is zero, the equations of motion that follow are not second order in time anymore. They're no longer of the form like F equal ma, which is second time derivatives. You know, everything else in physics we know of is just second order in time, which means that if you give the initial condition and the derivative, if you give the position of a stone and its initial velocity, then you can calculate the trajectory. But if there are higher order terms, then in order to calculate how a rock is flying, you have to give its position, its velocity, its acceleration, and, you know, the higher order time derivatives up to potentially many orders in order to even be able to calculate how it flies. Now, it turns out that in 3 plus 1 dimensions, if space-time has 3 plus 1 dimensions, this is all you can do without violating that principle. You can't add extra terms over there and still hope that your equations of motion are second order. No, if you insist on second order, this is as far as you can go. However, it turns out that in other dimensions, higher dimensions, you can have more terms. But not just generic terms, they have to be particular terms. And if you do, then you can still have second order equations of motion. You can still have a well-defined Cauchy problem of that kind. And all of these solutions, actions were worked out by David Lovelock, who was here at the university in the applied math department, and I don't know, maybe 30 years ago, worked that out. So what are the equations of motion then? The action principle is as usual to require that the action is extremal, so that the functional derivative of the action with respect to all of the degrees of freedom is vanishing. Remember why that is, right? It's we discussed it briefly earlier. Quantization is the Fourier transform. Solving the classical theory is the Legendre transform, right? That's the stationary phase. And the stationary phase condition is that condition. Okay, so the classical action differentiated with respect to the degrees of freedom equal to zero, this is the set of equations of motion. So if the phi are the collection of other fields, like gluon field, electromagnetic field, quark field, and so on, electronic field, the action varied with respect to all those fields, set equal to zero, gives you the equations of motion for them, like the Maxwell equation, the Dirac equation, and so on, Yang-Mills equations. They are all contained in here. And then if you differentiate the total action with respect to the metric, then you get the Einstein equation. If you differentiate the action with respect to the Klein-Gordon field phi, you get the Klein-Gordon equation. All those equations are coupled partial differential equations. Okay. So in principle, we now have a method to calculate all of the equations of motion. And how do we then quantize? Well, once we have the equations of motion, then all we need to do is undo the Legendre transform. Remember how we did the Legendre transform? We started with the Hamiltonian formalism, and we took the pi, the canonically conjugate field pi, Legendre transformed that. Right? And then we found out that that is phi dot, or at least it was in Minkowski space. But in any case, we did this Legendre transform from the Hamiltonian that depended on phi and pi, and then got a Lagrangian that depended on phi and what we call beta. Now, the Lagrangian was an integral over d3x, just like the Hamiltonian. So we upgraded that to d4x. We also did a time integral. That's what gave us the action. Now we need to do this in the reverse. We have the action. We will drop the time integration, obtain the Lagrangian. And then we will do an inverse Fourier transform, inverse Legendre transform to obtain the Hamiltonian. And thereby we will uncover what the pi is. And once we have the canonically conjugate field pi to each of the degrees of freedom, we can then impose the canonical commutation relations and quantize the theory, second quantize the theory. Okay, but before we do that, let's look at the equations of motion of gravity. So here are the equations of motion of gravity. I assume you've seen that. If we functionally differentiate the action with respect to the metric, then we get two sorts of terms. One sort of term is on the left-hand side of the Einstein equation, and the other sort of terms is on the right-hand side. Namely, when we functionally differentiate the Einstein action, which is one of the terms of the total action, then we get the left-hand side. So this is the functional derivative of the Ricci scalar and the cosmological constant with respect to the metric. The cosmological constant gives us a term because the cosmological constant is still multiplied with the square root of g. There's still a g dependence in there. On the other hand, the total action also contains the Klein-Gordon action and, you know, the action of all the other fields, electromagnetic fields and Young-Mills fields and so on. And if we functionally differentiate all these actions, all these matter actions with respect to the metric, we obtain what is called the energy-momentum tensor or the stress-energy tensor. So the left-hand side is ds gravity by dg mu nu, and the right-hand side is d Klein-Gordon action plus other action by dg mu nu. So t mu nu is the stress-energy tensor, and it has contributions from all types of fields. In particular, the Klein-Gordon field contributes to the energy-momentum tensor, this particular expression here. So it contains kinetic terms, more kinetic terms, and then possibly potential, which is just some function of phi. And for example, the mass term m squared phi squared would be counted in cosmology as a potential term. I realize that all of this is slow if you know it, and fast if you don't. So it's very difficult to get the right speed here. So please do ask questions if you want. All right. So as I said, it's difficult to quantize the degrees of freedom of space-time, to quantize gravity itself. I think the main reason for that is that it's very difficult to pinpoint what exactly the degrees of freedom are. And what we will do, therefore, in this course is that for the most part, but not all the time, but for the most part, we will assume that the space-time is classical and is known as a background. So we do know that, for example, space-time is evolving according to some FRW solution, and we are given the exact evolution of it. And then we will calculate how a quantum field reacts to that. How does a quantum field react to space-time expanding underneath it? And as you will see, there will be amplifications of quantum fluctuations, and the appearance of horizons will do things to the quantum field. But gravity will be just classical and given. But later we will see how we can and have to include the quantization of a certain part of the metric. So we will identify some degrees of freedom in the metric, and we will quantize them too. And I'll give you a quick overview of why we'll have to do this. It turns out that in the Einstein equation, is it still on this? Oh no, it was a previous one. Yeah. In the Einstein equation, we have here the degrees of freedom on the right-hand side of the matter fields, such as the Klein-Gordon field. On the left-hand side, we have the metric. And now imagine that we have fluctuations here on the right-hand side of the matter fields. This must mean that there will be fluctuations over here too. You can view it this way, that there's a certain number of degrees of freedom that the metric has, and there's a certain number of degrees of freedom that the matter fields have. But the total number of degrees of freedom that both of them have is smaller. And the reason is that the Einstein equations are equations. They say that such and such in terms of these degrees of freedom is such and such in terms of those degrees of freedom. So we will find in particular that the so-called inflaton field, which is a Klein-Gordon field, sort of meshes with a degree of freedom of the metrics that you can't distinguish them anymore. You can choose coordinates, you can choose a coordinate system such that it looks like the metric doesn't fluctuate, there's only a Klein-Gordon field fluctuation. But you can also choose a gauge or a coordinate system, same thing, such that it looks like the Klein-Gordon field is not fluctuating, all the fluctuations are in the metric. You can't even separate the two. And that's why there's only a linear combination of the two that actually is physically observable. There's a linear combination of the inflaton field and the metric, a scalar part of the metric, which is independent of the choice of coordinate system. And that is the degree of freedom that needs to be quantized, and that's the one that's observable, and that's the one that causes the temperature fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. Okay, but that's just anticipating. Where were we here? Right. So initially, we will, for quite a while in this course, we will assume that the space-time evolution is classical and known. And then only later we'll be worried about how that acts, how the matter fluctuate, quantum fluctuations of the matter interact with quantum fluctuations of the metric. Okay. So the Klein-Gordon equation. If we take the total action and functionally differentiate it with respect to the Klein-Gordon field, set that equal to zero, we get the equations of motion for the Klein-Gordon field. And here's the Klein-Gordon action. And if you now use that we know how to do functional derivatives, here's the equation, the general Euler-Lagrange equation, then you can work out what the Klein-Gordon action is in general, Klein-Gordon equation is in general relativity. And here it is. That's what you get directly from doing the functional differentiation. In order to make it a bit more interesting, I put a term, a potential term also in the action, which was lambda phi to the fourth, which means that the field is also interacting with itself. Then the Klein-Gordon equation looks like this. If you drop the phi to the fourth term, which in the action is to the fourth power, in the equations of motion is only to the third power because we did a functional differentiation. If you drop that, then that's just the Klein-Gordon equation. And with that, it's the interacting Klein-Gordon equation, self-interacting Klein-Gordon equation. So this is how this now looks like. It doesn't look very much like the Klein-Gordon equation that we remember, right? It was just second time derivative minus the Laplacian acting on phi plus m squared equal to zero. But now we have 1 over square root of absolute value of the determinant of g, and so on, and lots of derivatives. Now, since this looks pretty ugly here, we give this thing a name. And we call it box, just like the D'Alembert operator in Minkowski space. And then the Klein-Gordon equation looks much more manageable, but it's still a messy business here with all of these derivatives. Maybe let's quickly check that we get back the usual Klein-Gordon equation. So when should we get back the usual Klein-Gordon equation? Well, when we can choose a coordinate system such that g mu nu is eta mu nu. In this case, this is just eta mu nu, and this is what? 1, right? So this is 1, this is eta mu nu, this is 1, and then we see that this is just derivative, it's just the sum of the second derivatives. So it becomes just the sum of the second derivatives, time derivative squared minus space derivative squared, and then the usual m squared term. But that's the covariant version of it. So we arrived here now. we now have in general relativity the equations of motion and everything else to do with it, like the action of the Klein-Gordon field. Now, at this point, arriving at this point, we have two ways to go to second quantization. We can either use Feynman's method and quantize directly from here. It's beautiful because it's immediately covariant, and I will mention a little bit how to do this. Or we can do it systematically and say, okay, we go from the action to the Lagrangian, then do a Legendre transform, find out what the canonically conjugate field to phi is. So we find the pi, what is it? And once we have that, we can impose the canonical commutation relation. And it turns out that the two formulations, Feynman's and the canonical, are the same. They arrive at the same predictions, but in quite different ways. Okay, so let me just comment a little bit on Feynman's method. So-called path integral, PI. So how do we do second quantization with the path integral? Let's assume that the fixed space-time is chosen and classical. So we're not trying to quantize gravity at this point. And we're given its metric, g mu nu of x, in some arbitrary coordinate system. So we assume the space-time to be given. Now, we want to calculate for every field configuration phi, for every way that it may behave in space and time, we calculate its Klein-Gordon action. So the Klein-Gordon action is given by this expression here, and we can evaluate what that is explicitly. Because we're given the metric, it's fixed background, might be an expanding space-time, for example, or a black hole or whatever. So we have g mu nu of x is given as a matrix-valued function of space and time. We can plug it in here and in there. And for every field configuration phi, for every explicit function phi of x and t, we can now calculate what that integral is, and we get a number. So every field is mapped into a number. Following Feynman, we can now calculate the so-called probability amplitudes for that particular field configuration, where we should perhaps call this field evolution, because it's the field as a function of x and t. So for every field evolution, phi, we obtain a probability amplitude, which is, by definition, e to the power I over h bar times the Klein-Gordon action. So it's a functional, right? So we plug in a phi and we get out a complex number, a phase. So then, what does Feynman do? Let's say we want to calculate the vacuum expectation value of the product of two fields, which is to say the correlation function of field amplitude. So we want to calculate what in the operator framework is the vacuum expectation value of the field operator at one place and at another place. This is a correlator, right? You remember how correlators work? See, the field fluctuates at location x prime. It fluctuates at location x. If they fluctuate completely independently, then the fluctuations of phi that are positive are just as often met with a fluctuation of phi at the other location that are negative than that they are positive, which is to say that the correlator would be zero. The average over all these fluctuations would be zero. But we don't find that. Quantum fields have correlated fluctuations because the vacuum state is an entangled state. So what we have is that this correlator is non-trivial. Let's say we want to calculate it with the usual formalism. Well, then what we would have to do is calculate this expression, the vacuum expectation value of the field correlator. You would have to express the phi in terms of A and A daggers, and that phi in terms of A and A daggers, use the canonical commutation relations, work out what it is. For Minkowski space, we would be able to do this because we know what the mode functions are. We know how to express phi in terms of mode functions and A and A daggers. But for curved space-time, yeah, non-trivial. We'll have to first find out what the pi hat is, and then the canonical commutation relations, calculate the mode functions, and then we can calculate things like that. And these are super important expressions to calculate because they tell us the correlation between, eventually, the correlation between the temperatures of the cosmic microwave background here and there. It's the same thing. I mean, this is the origin of this temperature fluctuation. Now, Feynman would say, forget about Hilbert spaces. Don't worry about canonically conjugate fields. Instead, Feynman says, this correlator, the so-called two-point function, because we evaluate the field at 2 points, this correlator can be calculated in a completely different way, too. Feynman says, this correlator can be calculated as the sum over all field configurations, and then you take the field, so you pick one field configuration, then calculate what it is at the location x, multiply with what it is at location x prime, multiply with its probability amplitude, and then sum that up for all field configurations, which is, of course, a very hard thing to do because it's a functional integral. You're path integrating over function space, and Feynman didn't specify what exactly that function space is. For example, whether it is the square integrable functions or something like that, and we still don't really know what it ought to be. Okay, but it turns out that this can be carried out in certain cases. If the theory is free, you can carry it out explicitly. Basically, because the ambiguities can be swept under the carpet here, because they end up in the normalization prefactor, which drops out when you normalize the theory. For interacting theories, it can also be done, but perturbatively. Okay, we will come back to the Feynman method at the end of the course. So let's remember where we are. We are here. We have everything fully covariant for general relativity, but first quantized. So let's do the Legendre transform backwards to get to the Hamiltonian formalism so that we can then impose canonical commutation relations. Let's remember. The general relativistic Klein-Gordon theory in the Lagrangian formalism takes this form, the action formalism. It's beautifully covariant. So now the important thing is, we are not going to change the theory. We're just going to change the appearance of it. We're going to do a Legendre transform to it. But we are leaving the theory as such the same. So we know this thing is covariant. Then no matter which weird way we transform this into another shape, as long as we do bijections, as long as we map simply into an equivalent formulation, we're still describing the same physics. So let's have a last look at the beauty of this, where it is still covariant and where it's still manifestly covariant, because soon we will have it in a different shape where the covariance of it is no longer so obvious. It's still there, just because we are doing invertible maps, but it's no longer apparent. So this is the beautiful Klein-Gordon action, fully covariant, and then doing the variation with respect to phi gives us the Klein-Gordon equation, which looks like this. Not so pretty, but covariant. Now we can read off what the Lagrangian is. Let's have another look at it. Oh, here it is. Okay, here's the action. What would be the Lagrangian? Well, we drop the time integration, right? Because we went from the Lagrangian to the action by adding a time integration, which, if you remember, we had to do in order to be able to do the functional differentiation lemma. So that time and space were treated the same way. Okay, so we read off the Lagrangian now. The Lagrangian is this. We drop the time integration. Other than that, it's just the same as the action. But already, it's no longer covariant as it stands. Now we do a Legendre transform back to the Hamiltonian formulation. So we start here with the Lagrangian formulation, which depends on phi and phi dot and the time derivative. And now we're going to do the Legendre transform back to the Hamiltonian formulation by Legendre transforming our phi dot. So how do we do this? Remember that in order to do a Lorentz transform, we have to first identify the variable that we want to get rid of, that we want to Lorentz transform. It's going to be the phi dot, because we want a pi dependence over here. Here it was still a phi dot. So what we do is we functionally differentiate the Lagrangian with respect to phi dot. And this is what we will call pi. If we are lucky, that is invertible, and we can express not only pi in terms of phi dot, but phi dot in terms of pi. And that's because we have phi dots occurring all over the place here. We need to replace them by pi's and phi's. So if we do this, if we functionally differentiate now the Lagrangian with respect to phi dot, here's the Lagrangian, we functionally differentiate with respect to phi dot, what do we get? We get a contribution from here. This contains a phi dot, because the mu can take the value zero, but also the nu can take the value zero. So we get two terms from here and from there, which will undo the factor of 1/2. But also, we will get this g mu nu, and we get the square root of g over here. What we obtain is that the Legendre transform canonically conjugate variable to phi dot is the L by d phi dot, which is this. So this is why we did all of this detour. We wanted to find out what the relationship is between pi and phi dot. Remember, in Minkowski space, pi was simply phi dot. Now it's no longer. This is what pi is. Let us look at it. In the case of Minkowski space, g is eta. Therefore, this square root of the determinant is 1. That's just the 1. In Minkowski space, this is eta 0 mu, which has only one contribution, namely when mu is equal to 0. And therefore, this is just phi dot. Right? So we recover that in Minkowski space, pi is phi dot. But in general, that's not so at all. If the metric is non-trivial, if it has off-diagonal terms, on the zero, if it has zero I components, and it generally will have for FRW spacetimes, for example, then we obtain here that pi contains time and space derivatives, because this sum will be non-trivial here. But we are in luck in that we can actually solve that equation for phi dot. See, let's write it out. Here's a sum over all mu. Let's write this as the case mu equals 0 plus the sum over I running from 1 to 3. If we do this, I can show both. Then what do we obtain? We obtain that pi is square root of g. And then we have the g naught, phi comma naught term, and plus where mu is running from 1 to 3. That's this part. And now we can solve that equation for phi dot, for phi comma 0. Yeah?
What if g of x t? You have the metric depends on time.
Yes, yes.
Is it because you're switching formulas or anything?
Oh, no, the metric is allowed to depend on space and time, yeah. It's fully covariant, the whole thing. And it will have to depend on time for FRW spacetime. The x dependence actually is usually negligible, but the time dependence is what matters because the spacetime is expanding. Yeah, so what we see here is an equation that relates pi to phi dot and the space derivatives of phi. So this means we can also express phi dot in terms of phi and pi. So we can express phi dot by simply solving that equation for phi dot, you know, putting this on the other side and dividing by that. We obtain that phi dot is pi divided by g naught naught square root of g minus this stuff. This is important because in the Hamiltonian formalism, we should not have any phi dot. We should only have phi and pi. So all occurrences of phi dot in the Lagrangian will have to be fixed by expressing phi dot in terms of pi and phi in order to make the Legendre transform complete. So the Hamiltonian is obtained by the Legendre transform, which, if you remember, works like this. It's the sum over, or in this case, integral over the new variable times the old variable, phi dot, which needs to be re-expressed in terms of phi and pi, because the Hamiltonian is supposed to depend only on phi and pi, minus, and this is the Lagrangian in terms of phi and phi dot. Here too, all occurrences of phi dot have to be replaced by this instead, so that it's only depending on phi and pi. So I leave it to you as an exercise to actually plug all of these things in and see how far the resulting expression for the Hamiltonian can be simplified. Later, of course, we will see the Hamiltonian because we will work with it a lot. Okay. So now how about the equations of motion? We know from the general properties of the Legendre transform that the equations of motion now take the form phi dot is dh by d pi, and pi dot is dh by d phi. It doesn't depend on what the Hamiltonian is, what the Lagrangian is. This is always, you know, these are the Hamiltonian equations of motion. We proved this earlier, right? We showed that whatever the Lagrangian is, whatever the Hamiltonian is, if they're related by Legendre transform, then the Hamiltonian equations on the Hamiltonian side are equivalent to the Euler-Lagrange equation on the side of the Lagrangian and the action. Right. Okay, so in this case too, we find that these equations, when you spell them out, just give you back the Klein-Gordon equation again. Well, they give you two equations. They give you the Klein-Gordon equation, this one, and that one is what? It's the relationship between phi dot, phi, and pi. All right, so we are now ready, finally, to do the second quantization. Right? In this picture, we arrived here now, where we have general relativity, still first quantized, but it's in the Hamiltonian formalism. We have the phi, and we have the pi, and we know exactly how the Hamiltonian looks like. Today we are finishing early because I figured that you all know GR, so we could go a little bit faster through that. Okay, do you have any questions? Well, if not, then see you on Friday. Yes.
When you talked about the path integral, you mentioned in the little black tests that the vacuum expectation value is hard to define. Can you elaborate on that? Why is that?
Oh, it's hard to evaluate the path integral. Actually, yeah, we have a bit of time. Let me show you. Here it is. So we studied in this course how we would do this. In the case of generic curved spacetimes with curvature, we'll have to figure out how to express the phi hat in terms of A and A daggers. Once we have that, we can work this out. Feynman tells us we get there in a different way, by path integrating this. But then how are we supposed to define even what that is meant, what that means? What is this path integral over phi? And you could try to discretize space-time, and then this d phi over all fields turns into a countable product of ordinary integrations, countably many, namely for every space-time point, you now have a field amplitude phi that you have to integrate over from minus infinity to plus infinity, and in the action, you have space derivatives and time derivatives that have to be approximated now, because everything is happening on a discrete space-time. The field takes a value on this lattice point and a value on that lattice point, but it's no longer a differentiable function. It just takes an amplitude here, takes an amplitude there. And then you can say, okay, the approximation to the derivative is just this difference between the two amplitudes divided by the distance of the lattice point. You can do that sort of thing, and that would give you lattice quantum field theory, and it's being pursued. Then you have to take the limit where the lattice spacing goes to zero. Very difficult, but in principle, that sort of thing is doable, and you can make quite some progress because computers nowadays can work with lattices that have a reasonable size. But still, you can't do lattices with like 100,000 sample points in every direction. Couldn't, because that would be 10 to the 15 points. And that's just in space. And then if you want to do it in time too, it's 10 to the 20 points. No computer can handle that. So you see, you can do at most grids of like 1,000 by 1,000 by 1,000 by 1,000 or something. And that's generous. Probably you can't even do that. Depends on the theory, how complicated it is. So in principle, you could do this numerically, no matter what is up here. Even if there are interaction terms, you could do this. But it's a numerical approximation. So instead, what you can do is try to do the integral without doing the integral. There's a trick. And the trick works like this. Imagine you want to integrate something like x to the power n e to the power minus x squared dx over r. Now, in this case, you can, in principle, do it the hard way and work out what that is. But you could also say, you could put here a plus jx. And then say that this is equal to dn by djn of, let's call it, let's say integral over r, and then it's e minus x squared plus jx dx, right? That's the same thing, because if you differentiate n times with respect to j, then what happens? What happens is that every time you differentiate with respect to j, an x comes down. Right? And you can interchange the derivative with the integral. If you're not sure about it, analytically, you have to check whether you have so-called dominated convergence, which you have. So you can actually exchange those two. Okay, so what that means is, I mean, ultimately, we're interested in this without the j, without that term. But that's easy to fix. We simply say at j equal to 0, right? And here, too, at j equal to 0. But notice what we have done here. By arriving at this, we arrive at a term at something that's easy to do, because we can do a completion of the squares. Then this is just a Gaussian. So this is something we can do. It's actually a Gaussian in J squared, right? So this is something like e to the power something and then J squared. Okay, so what that means is we reduced it to a Gaussian integral. It turns out that there's an n here, and the n is a normalization factor. And the normalization factor is the same integral again, but without these terms. So you have to divide by that same integral again, but without those terms. What is that? That's just the Gaussian itself. And so what this means is that we can work out what these integrals are without ever knowing what that Gaussian integral itself is, because it gets divided out. We can express everything as derivatives, combinatorial coefficients coming from that derivative. multiplied with whatever the Gaussian is. And then that quotient is what that is. So the overall strategy for evaluating path integrals like this is to do this trick. In here, in the Klein-Gordon action, and generally in all actions, there will be terms that are quadratic in phi. We label them as being terms that give us essentially a Gaussian. Right? So here we sort the terms in here into those quadratic ones and higher order terms. The physics of it is that the quadratic ones describe free quantum field theories and the higher order terms describe interaction, self-interactions or interactions with other fields. So we sort this action here into a quadratic part plus non-quadratic term. And then we apply that trick again, where we write e to the power of I times the action total as e to the power of I times quadratic action plus I times interaction. Interaction terms are all those terms that are not quadratic. So we write this as, actually I should write it like that, e to the power I times S interaction of phi, e to the power of I times the quadratic action of phi. And actually, we're dealing with the path integral, of course, right? So here's a d phi, d phi, d phi. And now, these interaction terms can be written as the integral sum over n equal 0 to infinity. And then we have these. Let me not bother with this. Let's just say it quickly in words, because then we can do that quickly. Remember, here we have x to the n, which can be written instead as dn by dj to the power n. Imagine we have a linear combination of these. Then we get a linear combination of those. Imagine we have a polynomial of these. It gives you a polynomial in derivatives. Imagine it's a power series in these. It gives you a power series in those. That's what we have here. We have a function of phi. This is polynomial. So the whole thing is a power series in phi. And so we can write this as equal to e to the power I times s. This is s of the interaction. And then instead of phi, we write here d by dj, and there's a minus I, and then we do integral ei s quadratic of phi plus I integral j phi d4x d phi at j equal to 0. So you see the trick that we did here? The true path integral, the true Feynman integral is integrating this over all fields. And then we split that into a quadratic action and non-quadratic term. The non-quadratic term here we view as a power series in phi. But by adding here a term e to the power j phi, we can produce powers of phi, whatever power of phi is in here. This is a power series in phi, right? Whatever power in phi we have, we can generate by differentiating with respect to j, which is what we do here. So we pull this thing out of the path integral by replacing phi with minus I d by dj. You see, we need a minus I you buy DJ to produce a phi. And this is doable again. Because it's just quadratic. We can complete the squares, and then we get something like this. E to the power of I, some number, and then integral j, and then some stuff, q, and then j, d4x. And you see, this is now doable. Because here we have a power series of functional derivatives. It's just the interaction terms. And here we have Gaussian stuff. It's just e to the power jj. So in order to evaluate the Feynman path integral, we have to write this as a power series and apply it to that as a power series. And then we have to do lots of derivatives on lots of powers of j. And you can imagine that this takes a lot of bookkeeping because we get, lots of derivatives on e to the power of integrals of j's, and so you get product rules and so on, and chain rule factors, right? Because you get, once you differentiate with respect to j, you get a qj down. Next time you differentiate with respect to j, you have to differentiate that qj, and also product rule, differentiate this, gets more of this stuff down. Feynman developed a bookkeeping method for this. Do you know how it's called? The Feynman rules. Right? This is the Feynman rules, bookkeeping for these derivatives there. Yeah, and the point is that this integral here, yeah, it looks Gaussian. And we know it's this, but the prefactor here, there's some prefactor, let's call it n tilde, that is technically infinite or ill-defined. Because when we do complete the squares, then we get this as a numerical prefactor, because it doesn't depend on the phi anymore. There's no phi integration. And then we are left with the path integral over the completed squares. We still have to path integrate over phi. And we don't know what it is, but it's a prefactor that cancels this one. So beautifully, we don't actually need to know what the path integral even over a Gaussian is, because it cancels out. And ultimately, we need the path integral not just over Gaussians. We need the path integral over polynomials times Gaussians. And the path integral over Gaussians multiplied with these interaction terms there. But all of these can be reduced to the path integral over just a Gaussian, where the prefactor doesn't matter because it drops out. The only thing that matters is this numerical prefactor here. And all of that then leads to the bookkeeping of the Feynman rules. We will do this in the last lecture of this course. We will do this exactly. And how we get the bookkeeping. If you're curious, you can already look up the last lecture of when I last taught it 2 years ago. And you will see how that exactly works. Oh, and by the way, this trick that you can turn multiplications into differentiations can be used as an integration trick. Can be used as an integration trick. So, for example, let's say we want to integrate f of x from a to b dx. It turns out we can express such integrals in terms of derivatives only. And we can do it like this. This is the integral from a to b, f of x, and then e to the power, let's call it ax dx for a equal to 0. Agreed? Oh, sorry, no, a is not a good variable here. Let's call it epsilon for epsilon equal to 0, epsilon being some variable. Maybe you think that it's, let's call it lambda, so that there's no misunderstanding that it should be small or anything. Okay. So we haven't changed anything, right? Now we can write this as the integral from a to b of f of d by d lambda of e to the power lambda x dx at lambda equal to 0. Do you agree? Right? Because we can write the f as a power series. Let's assume we can expand it as a power series. Then every term x to the power n, let's say if f was x to the power n, then this would be dn to the power d to d lambda to the power n. So, you see, the n derivatives here will do the same job. They will bring down n powers of x, producing x to the power n. And if f is a linear combination of these guys, then we just get a linear combination of that, right? So what we can do is we can write the integral like this. Here we had f of x, but now here it's an operator. It's a power series in derivatives. You may wonder, what did we gain? Well, what we gained is, I hope that this thing, okay. The point is, we can now write this as f of d by d lambda of integral from a to b, e lambda x dx at lambda equals 0. Because this thing doesn't depend on x anymore. That means we can write that. I'm just writing the whole thing. See, this we can carry out. So what we obtain is that the integral from a to b of f of x dx is f of d by d lambda of e to the power of lambda b minus e to the power of lambda a divided by lambda at lambda equals 0. Okay. So we expressed integration completely in terms of differentiation. Similarly, you can prove that the integral f of x dx over r is actually limit epsilon to 0 of f of d epsilon plus f of minus d epsilon divided by epsilon. See, this looks very much like the Newton formula, but it's integration instead of differentiation. And it's obtained from that formula by suitably carefully taking the limits for a to minus infinity and b to plus infinity. But you can also do this not starting with a to b. You can just jump in one go and then derive integral minus infinity to infinity f of x dx. Of course, your functions have to be in suitable classes of functions, but it works very generally. This is also 2 pi f of minus I dx Dirac delta of x at x equals 0. Anyway, you see, so this is, in principle, these are just things inspired by quantum field theory when you do the perturbation according to Feynman. But it turns out you can do it also for ordinary integrals. When my collaborators and I first found out about these things, we did all of these calculations that I did down on the board for the path integral and for functional integration and functional differentiation. And we sent it to a journal. And then one of the referees said, well, that's all good and fine, but who can evaluate path integrals anyway? If this is true, it should also work for ordinary integrals. So we thought we are screwed. But it actually works, right? You can prove under which circumstances you can do this trick. And it's very general. And then you can just do ordinary integrations in this way. And it's nice for machines because machines know how to differentiate, right? There's no imagination required for differentiating. You just use product rule, chain rule, so super trivial. Whereas integration is, of course, always a bit like playing chess. So then we published these things, and we worked with the company Maple, MapleSoft, and it's in Maple now. If you integrate with Maple, it uses that. And it's good at it. It can do integrals now that Mathematica cannot. Anyway, we will come back to the Feynman method at the end of the course. Any further questions? Maybe play around with this. Okay.